Good morning, everybody, and welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you all here to help celebrate this very special event with the First Lady of Afghanistan, Rula Ghani, joining us. It was my great pleasure to meet her when I was working in Afghanistan between 2009 and 2011. I first got to know her husband, who was working hard for reform at that time, as he always has, and then had the pleasure of getting to know her, and was struck by her dedication, her thoughtfulness, her courage, really, to keep working with a long-term vision for Afghanistan, her graciousness, and her wisdom. And that has stuck with my wife and I, those impressions, since we had the pleasure of getting to know her and helping work for all good things for Afghanistan, as we tried to do. Since becoming First Lady, she has continued this work for the vulnerable in Afghanistan, women and children and drug addicts, among others, impressively working to create openings for women in business. When I was in Afghanistan and helping to oversee some of our programs there, I saw the creativity, the dedication, the desire of Afghan women to contribute to their families and to the economy and to Afghanistan. Through the businesses that they could create, and that was, it was very inspiring. I'm very happy to see a Women's Chamber of Commerce now active and existing in Afghanistan. I've noted the First Lady has worked in support of national initiatives on the marriage of young children, trying to get respect for the law in place in Afghanistan, not to have those child marriages, and realizing that that cuts off so many opportunities for education and often creates unfortunate situations of abuse and poor health. And in that connection, also very happy to see how she's worked in support of centers for treating drug addiction for women and children, but also for men, which remains a serious problem, especially in certain parts of Afghanistan. Her work similarly for the care of women in prisons has been very impressive. Her support for the family affairs units and the police force, which go in and help diffuse and find solutions to places where there is potential abuse that could take place. Her long-standing work in support of children on the streets through Ashiana, and others. And then finally, recently, I've seen in recent months a convening of several different meetings and just talking last week here in Washington a bit about the important role that women can play in support of peace. There's been a lot of discussion of the strategy of the United States, the new strategy moving forward on Afghanistan. But a key part of that strategy is to get to the situation where peace is more and more possible and becomes a reality. And one of the themes of Rula Ghani has been that women can encourage peace both at the micro level as well as to play a role at higher levels. And I think that is very important. So we look very much forward to hearing her thoughts about this, these topics. And I think we're going to see a short video first, and then Dan Rundy will moderate a conversation with Afghanistan's First Lady. Thank you very much.
Rushdie to stop it out on his son Sammy Massey.
Your Excellency, could I ask you to come on up, please? Please join me in welcoming the First Lady of Afghanistan. That was great. What a great video.
I know.
Fabulous. It's not your first visit here to CSIS. You had a very successful visit, I guess, about a year ago with our program, Smart Women, Smart Power. I want to recognize my friend Beverly Kirk, who's here, who helped facilitate that and has helped make the Smart Women, Smart Power program really a wonderful keynote program here at CSIS. And we really appreciate you being here. We're so pleased to hear that you were back in town and we wanted to have you come back. There's a lot of things we wanna talk about with you, Your Excellency. I think the first is, could you just, I love this video. Could you just comment a little bit about this video?
Hello, everyone. The reason I wanted to show a video is because sometimes, you know the adage that a picture is worth a thousand words. I wanted you to see Afghan women at work. And actually, this video is the video produced by the recently formed Chamber of Commerce of Women in Afghanistan. And it was done, the video was prepared by one of their members, the person who has the IT company. Just to let you know that women of Afghanistan are not waiting for people to come and help them. They are already engaged. And because they are engaged, we need to help them, because they will really, every little bit of information, of funds that you provide them, will be put to good use. They're very serious about what they're doing. They're very dedicated. They often are mothers having children at home. They often have large responsibilities in their enterprise. I was hoping to see Manisha Wafek. I don't think she's here. Manisha is not here. Okay, maybe she will arrive later. She is the head of the of this organization. She has a whole factory, a clothes factory, and she has three kids. And she has managed during the past few months to put together a chamber of commerce. So
in her spare time.
Exactly. So that's what I want to say, that contrary, when I first became First Lady, I was appalled at the narrative, and the narrative was that Afghan women were really very weak. Afghan women were sitting in the corner of their homes, not doing anything, just being told to do things and being kept quiet. And maybe there is a proportion that are in such situation, but Afghan women in general is a very strong woman, very resilient, a woman that has survived four decades of war and has had to be very resourceful in terms of finding the ways to make ends meet for their family, for their children. And even sometimes they were widows. They needed to figure out how to manage without a male support. So it's basically, I think maybe if you want to summarize how I see my role among others is to say Afghan woman is a very strong woman. Afghan women really can deliver, and this is why Afghan women deserve to be helped.
Yes.
Yeah. Good. And so you saw here in that thing, I mean, there is a variety. I'm not saying they're not running factories yet, but these are small and in the medium enterprises. They have started by themselves. and they are able to run them and profitably. Some of them have been several years already doing that. And eventually, with a little bit of help, and with especially help with helping them improve their products. Quality control is very important. Improve their products and help with, then if you have an improved product, then you can go to any market and the markets will welcome you.
You know, we have done a series of things here at CSIS about the non-military side. Ambassador Wayne has really helped us here at CSIS focus on this non-military side of the conversation. Too much of the conversation in Washington is about security as it relates to Afghanistan. I think it's extremely important. I'm the first person to say we need to have a conversation about security in Afghanistan, but I think when I talk to military leaders, they talk about the need to change facts on the ground, to engage women in the economy, to have agriculture happen, to have people go to school, to have investments made, to have infrastructure built, all these things. Could you talk a little bit about, let me talk about girls and education. If I recall correctly, Your Excellency, in the year 2000, I believe there were zero girls in school in Afghanistan or something around, I think literally zero girls in school. Now, how many young women are in school today in Afghanistan?
I will always be reluctant to give numbers because our Office of Statistics is still not up to par.
We're working on it. But
it's several millions.
Several millions.
Yes. I think the question we need to ask is what is the quality of education in Afghanistan? And unfortunately, the quality of education is still not as good as it used to be before the civil war, before the 4 years of four decades of war. And when it comes to education, I want better education for both boys and girls, and make sure that girls attend the schools. But I think we need to really help improve the state of education so that all children of Afghanistan are able to get a good education, a solid education. What has changed, though, I had, just before I left Kabul, I had a delegation from Human Rights Watch,
yes,
who have just come out with a report on education in Afghanistan. And they had traveled over 2 years. They had traveled in provinces. They had talked with people. And the one thing that struck them is that everywhere, men and women, I emphasize on men, were saying, we need to educate our daughters.
Really?
So at least the mentality has changed from the mentality of the times of war, where it was said, we don't really need to educate women. We will just, you know, the boys can go to school, the girls have to stay home and take care of the chores. No, the mentality has changed. They realize that they need to educate the women too. And in this respect, I want to relate an anecdote. You know, I have an open door policy, and whoever wants to come and see me, as long as they justify why they want to see me, can come. And there was this this man from Khost who said he wanted to introduce to me his two daughters.
Mm.
And I said, okay, let him come. And he came in traditional garb with the longi and all that, and he had his two daughters, slim, elegant, two young women, but with a surgical mask on their face. You know, they didn't want people to see their face. And the story was, he was very proud to tell me, so this is a very conservative person, if his daughters have to be all wrapped up and even cover their face. And yet, he wanted to tell me that his two daughters are in first year of the Faculty of Medicine. They were learning to become doctors. It's really moving when you see a father that insists that his daughters have to become doctors. And then he proceeded to tell me that actually when he was in his late teens, early 20s. He had been witness to a woman in his family who died in childbirth. Mm. And she died in childbirth because there was no doctor, female doctor, to attend to her. And there was no question that they would accept a male doctor to approach her. And then he promised himself, he said, I promise myself when I get married, if I have daughters, they will become doctors so that they will be able to take care of their families. So this really confirms what the Human Rights Watch delegation had told me, that there is now a much greater inclination to send girls to school.
It's incredible. That's incredible. So, I mean, I think it's just really important that people understand that we went from zero girls in school to several millions. I've seen numbers as high as 3.5 million women in school in Afghanistan. And I think the kinds of stories you're telling reflect that sea change that's happened. It sounds to me, we have a lot of people in Washington who are such negative, very negative on Afghanistan and pessimistic. My argument has always been that you're telling me that 3 million women in school over 15 years isn't going to change a society? That's ridiculous. Of course it's going to change a society. And could you talk a little bit about just some other examples about how you see the presence of women in school, how that's changing the country? Because I find it ridiculous that it's sort of as if that it's seen as if Afghanistan is sort of the static country that's not dynamic or not changing as reality changes on the ground.
Well, it is because, of course, there is this positive that the mentality is changing, but there is also the negative that they are reluctant to send their children if there is no female teacher.
Yes. So, or female bathrooms.
Or female bathrooms. Right. But it's the teachers, especially in the villages. If there is no female teacher, they will not send their daughter. And I can, I can relate. I would be more comfortable with a female teacher if I have a daughter. But so the problem is not necessarily their willingness, but the problem is that there are not enough women that are being trained as teachers that are from that province. Because we train a lot. This is one thing that unfortunately international aid has a kind of a bad situation that has kind of been enhanced, is that a lot of effort has gone into urban center. We have five main urban center. We have Kabul, Mazar, Herat, Jalalabad, and Kandahar. And outside those centers, a lot of the international aid agencies will tell you it's not secure. We cannot go there. We cannot work there. But they don't really think outside the box and train people who will go and work there. Because we need to train the young women that are in those provinces to become teachers. Because a girl from Kabul will not go and live in a village where there might not be running water, where the bathroom facilities are not adequate, where, I mean, it's self-evident. And somehow, this is my plea to whoever is here with international aid agencies, please find a way to train people from the provinces to get services in the provinces. This would be really very important and change a lot. So your question was
just about the changing. So I think that's actually a really important takeaway. Yeah. Here is, I think, one of the homework assignments for us at CSIS will be on this issue of rural female education and rural teacher training. I can remember meeting a minister of education 10 years ago when I was in the Bush administration. He had walked with a limp, and he was talking about this 10 years ago, saying that we needed, he put the numbers on the board in terms of, this is how much money I need from the international community to pay for teacher training. And it was not a large number. So it's something that if we're not doing enough of, and that's certainly something that should mean that's the sort of thing that ought to be done. It's so self-evident. But my question to you, Your Excellency, is I'd like you just to tell a couple more stories about the changing landscape, the changing mindset. Because of all these women in school, what are some of the things that yes, there are these constraints of there's not enough female teachers in rural areas who speak the regional dialects, and that is fixable. But I know that you've had 15 years of girls in school. There are additional things that have happened as a result of that. People in the development business will talk about having girls in school have all sorts of incredible positive aspects on a society, whether it's in terms of number of children that they have or their willingness to go to seek higher education. I mean, I would assume that the number of women, for example, at the universities in Afghanistan is probably close to 50% at this point.
Not exactly 50%, but I do have an anecdote for that, and that was a young woman who was chief of party for one of the pillars of Promote, and she came to me one day with a picture, and she's standing in a hall, and the hall has 600 young women sitting at desks waiting to take an exam. And she told me, Bibi Jean, you cannot believe I had the hair on my arms stand up. She had come to Kabul in 2002 she had been in the States, but she's an Afghan, born in Afghanistan. And she had come to Kabul and had tried to open an office. And she said, I looked everywhere, high and low. I could not find even a 12th grader girl who could be my secretary. And here I was, 12 years later, or 14 years later, and I'm seeing the sea of women. They all have BAs.
Yeah.
And they're ready to take an exam to be able to join a training program for working in the government. So yes, there are a lot of these kind of things. I would like to mention one other thing, because it's not just international aid, the government is also doing some things. And that was in Afghanistan, we have this system that in order to enter university, you have to sit for an exam, and they call it the concours. And unfortunately, in the past few years since the war and all the disturbances, it was one of the most corrupt processes. And it allowed only people who knew somebody or who were the sons or the nephews of somebody to be able to reach university. It was very disheartening for the teacher at the university. The professors were complaining that they didn't have students who were willing to learn. They were just there to spend the time or not even showing up. I mean, it was very disheartening. And actually, there was a young man who worked on this concours, the system of the concours, and made it, brought a lot of technology into it. So, for example, no two persons sitting next to each other will have the same exam. So they cannot cheat. Then there is the biometrics, so we know that it is the person who should be taking the exam who's taking it. And then for the correction of the exam papers, it's a machine. It's electronically done. So, and there is no name. It's just a number. So it's unbelievable. From the first year, it has completely changed the composition of the student body, and many more women were able, on the basis of merit, to be join the university. I had the privilege to sit at the table, had lunch with one. There were several students, and this one girl was from Mazar. And I asked her what faculty she was at. She said she was in the Faculty of Medicine. And then she laughed and she said, my mother kept telling me, I kept telling her, I'm going to be a doctor. And my mother kept telling me, you're dreaming. We know nobody. We are nobodies. How do you think you're going to be able to enter the university, let alone get into the Faculty of Medicine? Because Faculty of Medicine is the highest grades go to the Faculty of Medicine. And she says, and here I am. You know, I made it. And it was wonderful that she was saying that. So this was something that the government was able to do, identify the person who could really rework this thing. And I'm very glad to say that today he has been appointed at the head of the Central Statistics Office.
This is the person who's reformed the test taking.
Exactly. And so I'm looking forward that in 2 years I'll be able to give numbers. Okay. Because you would have good systems in place.
But it's in the million. We know it's in the millions of young women. We know it's in, we don't know the exact number, but it's a big number.
It is a big number. We see the anecdotal results. There are a lot more women that are finishing high school, at least in the urban centers. Because as you mentioned, in a lot of places there are no toilet facilities for girls. And that is, I used to think it's because by the time they reach puberty, that the parents would keep them at home. And actually, maybe this is one factor, but the major factor is because they start needing to use a bathroom more regularly. And if there is no bathroom, they stay home. One month after the other, then they stop going to school. So having just the mere fact of having bathrooms can really help keep women, girls in school. And you will note that the Prime Minister of India, Mr. Modi, has exactly the same kind of goal, that he wants by 2019 that every school in India offers bathroom facilities.
Of course.
For girls.
I wanted to just make a parenthetical about data and statistics. We did a report, if you have trouble sleeping at night, we did a report on statistics and development, but it actually is quite important. These things, I said, this is really a boring and mind-numbing topic, but it's really quite important. If you want to have a successful society, successful societies invest more and more in good statistics and in good data. And it's a sign when you see a country like Afghanistan sending its best thoughtful people to help run statistical agencies. It's very important. It shows the signs of progress. Development takes a long time. And the conversation we're having about is over 15 years of investments in women. You're seeing them now enter the universities in large numbers. This is unbelievable. I mean, this is an incredible thing. But you couldn't do that in 24 months. You couldn't do that in 48 months. This is a 10 or 15 year project. In the United States, the story of Plan Colombia is known well, Your Excellency, or at least in Washington policy circles. And that was a 20 year project. People talk about the turnaround in Colombia. I would argue that there are many, many things in Afghanistan that are going the right way, but it's taken 10 plus years for that to go the right way. Yes. But those stories don't get out enough. So I really appreciate you being here and telling these stories, because it's really important we understand that there's been an incredible amount of progress. I want to talk about a couple of other topics that I know that women have an important role to play in. I want to talk about the issue of corruption. And you've mentioned it in the United States had, the city of Chicago, and there's other famous cities and there are famous states in the United States that are well known for their having had corrupt practices. So we're not the only, Afghanistan isn't the only country that has had challenges with corruption. But if you could just talk a little bit about, there's a perception that Afghanistan has significant corruption problems. Can you talk a little bit about corruption, and could you talk a little bit about the role women play in helping to stop corruption?
Sure. First of all, I want to say that when I got married about 44 years ago now, Afghanistan was not a corrupt country. Mm. Okay, so it's not something that is Afghan. Okay. after the war, you have to think, when you live in war conditions for four decades, you're not living, you're surviving. You're making sure to be remain alive, to the that the people around you remain alive. So the difference between right and wrong gets fudged, and a lot of things become allowed or at least feasible because you're trying to survive.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to pass judgment on that. What had happened since 2001 is that the previous administration was not very focused on corruption or on kind of not allowing corruption. But the international, this also coincided with a time where international aid came in the millions, if not the billions, and some people maybe even say trillions. But one thing that the international aid agencies have not done is monitor. They did not really monitor where the money went. So there has been a lot of corruption, especially that money was in abundance. We have a slightly different situation now, because in as much as the money is not as abundant as before, and I think that the international agencies really have drawn their lessons, that they need to know if they do this program, what results they're going to get. And if they don't get their results, then it's conditional. They're not going to give more money. So there is more now, more attention that is being given to where the money goes. Corruption, you have two ways of combating it. You can go after the corrupt people, but you also can build systems that would prevent the corruption from happening. And I think the present unity government has been concentrating on building systems that will prevent corruption, where the flow of a particular procedure in a ministry is regulated so that it doesn't go through 20 people who need to put a stamp, and each time they need to put a stamp, they will require some money. Okay, something like that. Or larger things where, for example, get involved into something if ever you have, they can check and they see that you have taken land that was not yours or was government land, and you have kind of built on it. I mean, illegal acquisition of land. There are a lot of small things like that. At the same time, this administration has pushed for a reform of the justice system. We had a very corrupt justice system, so if people complained, they never had, they never got their rights recognized. I remember I had given a talk a couple of years ago on the reform of the justice system. And at the end, a young lady came up to me and told me, "Oh, I am so thankful that you've said thank you, thank you, thank you." And I said, "Well, you know, I just talked about the reforms of the justice system." She said, "No, it's not this. When I was divorcing my husband, we went through the courts. And we went through the first court, then through the appellate court, and then through the Supreme Court. And I was winning throughout. And at the end, he got everything." Because there was a little caveat that the Chief Justice could overturn any kind of decision, even if it had gone through the Supreme Court.
It's crazy.
So it's, you know, open.
Yeah, it's open season.
Season for
corruption
for
and
corruption.
Yeah.
So, for example, the first thing the new Chief of Justice did is to abolish this rule and abolish another rule that if ever there was any kind of financial punishment, he could also overturn. So this has been, so at least some of the decisions are being now confirmed, and if she went back to the court, she would. But she thought she was crazy. She thought she hadn't done all that she needed to do. The other thing is that we also now have a very good attorney general, and we have under him a lot of prosecutors. And we are in the process of training quite a few women. I think for the prosecutors, it's about 120 women prosecutors to go all over Afghanistan. As far as the judges are concerned, we have you see why I don't want to give numbers.
But there's a significant number of female judges.
We have, I think, 200 female judges. Whereas our neighbor, Iran, they immediately dismissed the one judge they had, which was...
the one female judge?
Yeah, Ebadi, I don't remember her first name, who got the Nobel Prize.
Oh, Shirin Ebadi.
Shirin Ebadi. The minute they came into power, they told her, you're a woman, you cannot be a judge. So we do have certain things. Of course, there are little problems because these judges are all from Kabul and they don't want to go to the provinces. This is a problem I mentioned earlier. And they are now being coaxed to go, but and we're trying to get some welcoming committees for them so that they feel comfortable there. But it is something that could have been done better if ever they had found
young women recruited from that region
who had gone to law school, or at least helped them get to law school. And it's a two-year program, it's a two-year training. So, I mean, it's really a solid training. So there are a lot of things that are improving from that point of view. More women judges mean that there will be better attention to women's problems. We have three court systems where the women would be really mostly there. The first one is, of course, the violence against women. The other one is a family court, and the third one is a children's court. And we're trying, we have these three courts in the urban center. We're trying now to have the three courts in all the provinces. Hence the need for women judges, hence the need for women prosecutors, hence the need for women policewomen. We didn't talk about
police. Do you have police women?
Oh, yes, we have police women. It's not, unfortunately, there were some women serving in police before this administration, but most of them, unfortunately, were there to bring tea and open the doors and make sure everything remains clean. Because they were, I think, a good proportion, maybe one third of them, if not one half, was illiterate. Okay, so it was women, you know, usually widows that did not have any other way of making
a living,
and so who came. And this is really with the help of NATO, that is really has a one section that is really looking at the training of women in the army and in the police. And we're having more and more, an increasing number of women, probably now in the hundreds. I think for police, the aim was 500, and we have not yet reached it. But in the army, it's many more. It's by the thousand. It's maybe they want 5,000, and we're working towards that.
I want to talk about how cell phones have changed Afghanistan. So in the year 2000, there were something like 50,000 cell phones in Afghanistan. I can imagine who had the cell phones in Afghanistan in the year 2000, but today there's, I don't have the exact number, but there's, it's in the, is it in the tens of millions, the number of cell phone subscribers? Yeah. It's something like this, something in the tens of millions. Mm-hmm. There's at least three, maybe four cell phone mm-hmm. providers in
yes.
Afghanistan.
Correct.
You have smartphones. One of the things mm-hmm. that struck me is that one of the cell phone companies is called Roshan, as mm-hmm. you well know, Your Excellency. One of the things that struck me was the, there is, if you want to send money, I think it's more sophisticated than whatever we have here in the U.S., if you want to send money or get paid, you can use your cell phone to get to for salaries. And could you talk a little bit about what the proliferation of cell phones have meant for Afghanistan and for Afghan women?
Yes, there are several projects, schemes to pay people directly through their cell phone. It is still in its infancy. It's not, I'm not really quite sure. I might be wrong, but I have a feeling it's not yet totally, it's not something that we're using all the time.
Yeah.
Because what was happening in this, there was a lot of corruption in this. I remember that from the time my husband first was Minister of Finance, and the money would leave in big bags. The salaries of the government employees would leave in big bags, and then distributed in each ministry for how many, I think. And there were several steps, and at every step, the money diminished. So by the time they received their salaries, it was not exactly what they were supposed to get.
So they're being paid $100, but they were getting $60.
Something along these lines. This was taken care of during the time of my husband, in as much as the flow of the money has been done through the bank.
Yeah.
And the bank are giving the salary. And so even if there is a little bit of corruption, it has been reduced. We would like to be able to do it directly to each person with their on their phone.
On their phone.
There is a lot of resistance from the banks.
Hmm.
Yeah. I wonder why. this is really just to let you know that we are aware and we're trying to work towards solution, but sometimes there are obstacles and we need to figure out how to go around these obstacles or remove them. So it takes time, as you said, it takes 10 to 20 years to be able to get rid of some of these impediments.
Could you tell us anything about, my sense is that even in the most remote parts of Afghanistan, women have access to cell phones. What can you just tell a story about either cell phones and women? There must be something that struck you.
What it is that now there are a lot of families in Afghanistan that have one or two or maybe more members who are living and working abroad, a lot of them in Pakistan, in India, but especially in the Gulf, but some of them also in Europe, in the States, in Australia. And the big revolution is the SMS, because it doesn't cost a lot. You can reach somebody all over the world, and they can answer back. It's a wonderful means of communication. And because of that, women are very, very keen on learning how to read and write so that they can be able to send these messages. Before that, there were efforts about, we have a very high rate of illiteracy, and there were efforts, people, I don't know how sustained were the efforts, but they would go into villages and say, let us teach you how to read and write. And the women would say, what for? What do I need it for? Why should I learn to read or write? Well, there they really have an incentive. And this is really helping them a lot. So what is happening is that because they have that, also I have another story, a group of women who are writers and poets. But they are from all over Afghanistan. And what they do for those women who are members who are in very faraway provinces cannot, because transport is really a very big problem for women in the provinces. Transport, they cannot really move distances without being accompanied by a maid. That's really a hindrance. So they wanted their members who were in those villages to be able to take part in their meetings. And so they would have a phone, put it on speakerphone, and the young woman or the older woman would read her piece, and then she would hear the comments of all the others. So phones have facilitated interaction, especially for women who are in places very traditional where they cannot get out of the house easily. Now, there is another aspect is that when they become entrepreneurs, then it is so important to be able to be in touch with your supplier, with your clients, with what's happening, finding out what the price of wool is, what the price of thread is, you know, all sorts of things. So women are really getting on the wagon and learning how to use phones. They really like it. And often they will have it in their pocket and then they go through all the folds to find their phone and get it out and see who's ringing them and why did they get a message. It's very heartening. I have a lot of positive stories like that. At the same time, I'm not naive. I know it's going to take a long time. But if you just sit back and say, well, there's so much to be done, we cannot do it, I might not see it in my own lifetime. But if you sit back and do nothing, when will it start?
So I want to talk about peace. I want to talk about the role of women in getting peace in Afghanistan. Could you talk about that, please?
So basically, in everything we've talked, it was more observing the women getting better. In peace, I have my little contribution here. There was some time at the beginning of winter, last winter, in the province of Ghor, which is a central province of Afghanistan. The news came out that 29 people of one family had been slaughtered.
Ugh.
Yeah. God. They also slaughtered their 500 sheep. So no income generating activity. Anyway, so my husband was really very upset and wanted to go and condole with them, and he was going to go in a plane, so I said, oh, there is space for me. I went there with a couple of my advisor. You were there. One of my advisors is here, Palosha. And so we went there, and it's a beautiful, it's a poor province, but it's a beautiful corner of the country. And we met with a lot of people, and eventually we had a meeting in the governor's office, a large office with a table all around, and then one or two, three rows of chairs. And we met the families that were against the wall on the side. And it was really very moving, because it was only the old women and the little children. They had really gone after all the adults. And then we sat, and some of the Willis Mishra, what do you call that? The leaders of the tribes stood up and started talking. And then a woman stood up. She used to be the governor before. And from what she was saying, we found out that actually, what I forgot to mention, in the media, it was Daesh that had done that. It was ISIS. So I was really very upset at ISIS. Anyway, we come there, and from what the discussion, the information we derived from the discussion, this was a local feud. It was between one warlord and his militia, and this kind of family that was probably prosperous if they had 500 heads of sheep.
Yeah.
And there had been some kind of
family
duel,
conflict,
a feud, and the young man of that family had killed the head of the warlord.
Oh boy!
And then the militia went and took its revenge and killed 29 people. So that made me start thinking, okay, it's true, we are being attacked by, we have like over 20 groups of insurgents, including the Taliban and ISIS, that keep attacking Afghanistan every corner, here, there. And you hear in the news that, they're gaining land. Keep in mind, these are hit and run operations. They come, they hit, and they leave. So maybe they are active in one third of the country, but that doesn't mean they have control on that one third. They have control on some outlying areas. They don't have control on any city. And so it's true we have these people, but we among us have lived four decades of war, and we are still interacting with each other as if we are competing on the same of the same resources. So I don't like you. You said something I don't like. You have a little shop at the corner. I go demolish your shop. You said something about my son. I'm going to go and take your daughter and impose her to marry my son.
Oh.
I mean, real stupid things that could be, should be resolved in a much more
better way.
More peaceful, more reasonable, more rational way. And so I discussed it with my advisors, and we decided the year before I had done a symposium where we gather 300 women at a time to discuss a topic. And the year before I had done it on the role of women in Afghanistan, because too many people were telling me there are not enough women that know what to do. And so I brought 300 very well-educated, very vocal, very verbal, very determined women, half of them from the provinces, so everybody could see, no, Afghanistan does have very strong women. Okay, so this year we did it on peace, and we called it Afghan Women Messenger of Peace. And the message was that we should not wait for the leaders to negotiate and get peace among the countries. We should start ourselves from our homes, from our places of work, from the schools, from the markets, from wherever, to try and normalize the fact that we have to be interacting with each other in a peaceful way. And we call that social peace. So we did that, and there was such enthusiasm among the women. And again, there we had half of them were from the provinces.
Well, if you go to, when you talk to women who are in Taliban-controlled areas, what do they say?
It depends whether they are Taliban women or whether they are women that are living in a place where there are Taliban. The ones that are, local and have to handle the Taliban are very resourceful. If there is a problem that is a local problem, they need to resolve it. And so they interact and they try through, persistence and a very respectful argument. I'm sure some people in the audience have heard me talk about the three cups of tea. That was
the book.
No, not the book. That was fake news.
Yeah,
the
that
book
was fake news. yeah, that was fake news.
No. The three cups of tea was this woman comes back to her village to visit her cousin, who's just been widowed, and finds out that her cousin has been kicked out from her house by a small Talib commander who has just arrived in the area. And it's a small house, it's just a one-room house and with a little bit of a garden. So she tells her, don't worry, I'll take care of it. She makes some tea, takes 3 cups, and goes up to see them, and gets inside and knocks at the door and says, peace be with you, salam alaikum, and I brought you tea, and puts, there were 3 people sitting on a toshak. The guy in the middle seems to be the commander and 2 acolytes. And and she pours tea. And she goes and sits in the corner. And she starts telling the story of this house, that it belongs to her cousin, who's now been widowed. She has no one else in the family to take care of her. She has 6 children. Mm. The little garden out there is the only her only source of nourishment, of food for her children. And she keeps pouring more tea and then keeps repeating. After 2 hours, they haven't said a word. They haven't even grunted. After 2 hours, the guy who's sitting in the middle with a Kalashnikov in between his knees stands up and tells his guys, come, let's go, let the widow have her house back. And she got the house back.
Amazing.
You know, that's what I mean. We can do a lot with just being perseverant, being also resourceful, being knowing how to present an argument, knowing what will. After all, these Taliban, they are people too. We should know how to handle them.
What do they want?
Unfortunately, most of these insurgents want to change our mentality and change our beliefs. Now, Afghanistan is a 99.9% Muslim country, and it has been that for several hundreds of years. Okay? So they don't need somebody to come and tell them what Islam is all about. So people don't necessarily agree with what they're saying, especially when you have groups like ISIS that beheads people, or comes and takes your young boys when they are 12 or 13 to train them to become their things, or to become suicide bombers. There isn't much love lost between the population and the insurgents. At one point, when first the Taliban came in the mid-1990s, they followed a time of a lot of chaos,
yeah,
and a lot of killing between factions. And so people thought, oh, okay, they're going to bring some peace, and our women will be respected. Well, slowly they realized it was not going to be the case. Right now, I don't think anybody has any illusions about the Taliban.
I've got 2 more questions, and I want to open it up.
Okay.
So, are you optimistic about the future of Afghanistan, and if so, why?
I'm extremely optimistic about the future of Afghanistan. And here, I would like Lida is here and Lima is here. Please stand up again. And any other young woman, Afghan woman that I know that has worked in Afghanistan. Okay, only the 2 of you are here. This is the future of Afghanistan. These are young women who have studied hard, who, in the case of Lima, she worked a lot before. Now she's back in the States to get her MA from Fletcher's. She not only has held jobs with lots of both foreign and governmental organizations, but she has also had a lot of impact socially. The last was organizing a youth conference, South Asia Youth Conference in Kabul, where 100 people came, young people, from all the countries, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Nepal, and all this, to create understanding among the young people of the region. Leda has been the chief of party for the Women in Leadership pillar of Promote. And she has, she is the one who told me, you need to get people from the provinces. And for that, you cannot do it from Kabul. You have to go in the provinces and you have enough women to create a selection committee that will select women from wherever, for whatever program. Select the women, they can be sent to training, but these women, you're sure they're going to go back to their provinces. So, but you've trained how many women in your program, Lida?
More than 10,000.
10,000. Wow. So, we have great women. We have great young women. We have older women also who are very active. But unfortunately, I have less hope with the older generation, whether they're women or men, because they have lived so intensely the past decades,
yes,
that it is very difficult for them to let go of the problems of the 80s and the 90s. And they're still, whenever they see each other, they still say, oh, in
1985,
you
this,
said
or
this, and you saw
that.
What I told you in 1994. I mean, it's ridiculous. We need to move on.
The good news, Your Excellency, is that Afghanistan's a young country.
Yes.
I think more than 60% of the society is under the age of 30. Is that, I think it's something like that.
It's under 70% are under 25.
Okay, so that means that the young generation's going to soon take over, and
exactly,
and it's going to be a better place. Give it a little bit more time.
But it is comforting to know that there are some that are already training to become
that are already
the next
taking
leaders,
roles of,
yes,
responsibility.
Yes. The women of the Chamber,
yes,
of Commerce.
Fabulous. Okay, so I have one last question. So Thanksgiving's coming up in the U.S. Mm-hmm. My family, they're very reasonable people. Mm-hmm. You know, Your Excellency, that I really support strongly the Afghan cause and what you're trying to do. But the average American, they may be reasonable and say, well, why are we still there? And why does the United States still have to be there? So if you were at my Thanksgiving table, and I was asked this question, and I'll be asked this question, and everyone here will be asked, if they go and talk about this, they'll say, that was great, but why are we still there, and why do we still have to be there? What do I tell my family members? What do I tell my fellow Americans when they ask that question? Because it's being asked a lot.
Let's not forget that 9/11 happened, and that it was planned by Osama bin Laden, was at the time living in Afghanistan. Okay. It was a big shock for all of America. Fortunately, it was the only shock you got. Some countries in Europe are getting shock after shock after shock. We are living in a global world. What happens in one place and has a ripple effect and can affect people in the other place. We need to build countries that are strong. Sometimes, unfortunately, for political reasons, and I don't do politics, international great powers like to have puppet regimes or weak countries to be able supposedly to manipulate them or to have them in their camp. Doesn't work. It's better to have a strong country that will not allow people like Osama bin Laden to do whatever he wants in their country. That will say, okay, you can come, you can stay, but please, no training camps, no whatever. No proselytization.
No funny business.
Oh yeah, no trying to distort Islam. You know, all these things, you need these countries to be strong. My heart bleeds looking at the Middle East today. We've destroyed Syria, we've destroyed Iraq, we've destroyed Yemen, we've destroyed Libya. What's going to happen in all these countries? There should have been different solutions. I am definitely not for violent solutions. I think I've seen how my country of origin, I grew up in Lebanon, has gone through 23 years of civil war, and I'm seeing how up till today they're trying to rebuild it and reweave the fabric of society. Society is very important. Families are very important. One reason that Afghanistan has a lot of positive prospects for becoming strong again is because we still have the unit of the family, a strong unit in Afghanistan.
Amen.
And it's our support network. And this I say for people who worry about the women rights, and I agree, women should be allowed to do a lot of things, but please don't couch it in terms that would mean that they have to leave their families. Their family is their biggest asset. It's their biggest support group. They need their families. What we need is for women to be respected within their families. So, to get back to your children, they need to realize that although they live here, I hope, a very happy life,
yes,
very secure life, and probably what they see on TV does not seem to affect them, that they cannot tell when this might affect them. It's becoming very clear in Europe. Fortunately, it's not that clear here in the States. You have been able to contain, but still you had the San Bernardino, and you may have had other things.
Yes, we've
too.
Had others.
We are all interconnected, and we should all be able to have a good life, a prosperous life, not have to live under dictators, not have to live in sordid conditions. And then everybody will be happy, and then tourism will flourish again, and everybody will be able to travel everywhere. I remember when I was in my late teens, people thought nothing of driving a car from Paris all the way to Damascus or to Iraq or even to Nepal. We had in Afghanistan, we had a lot of hippies coming through. They were attracted by Kathmandu.
Amazing.
And the pleasures of Kathmandu. Anyway, so that's what I would say, is that learn about the rest of the world and don't accept that the rest of the world lives in dire condition. Everybody should have a right to a good life, and everybody should have the right to live in peace.
Thank you. You've been very patient. Thank you very much. This audience. Okay. I'm gonna take four questions. My two friends here in the audience, this woman here, and I want to hear from Emmy Simmons. Those four. So we'll start here with this woman here.
Thank you very much. Joseph.
چخو فارسی
صحبت میکنین. It was wonderful, you know, discussion. I'm from Afghanistan, but your knowledge and information is more than me. I'm really proud of you. Thank as you. An Afghan woman, although you're not from Afghanistan, but you improved, really. I'm you. Proud of you and congratulations. I would like to ask my question in Dari, mm-hmm. as long as I know. You speak good Dari and Pashto.
Okay. Yeah.
My name is Nazira Azim Karimi. I'm Afghan independent journalist. Mm-hmm. مثل که شما صحبت کردین در همه عرصه ها برای زنها بسیار کار کردیم قابل قدر است. یک مسئله که دیروز در صفحات اجتماعی فیسبوک تویتر و اینا ما خواندم و دیدم یک خانم بسیار شکایت میکرد که استریت هارسمنت آزارهای خیابانی زنها را بسیار آزار میده. خانم جورنالیست بود و گفت مجرد که از خانه خود بیرون میشیم بر ما الفاظ بد زده میشه. استریت هاربل هارسمنت ریگاردینگ وومن. Any comment?
If you don't mind, I'm going to collect the four questions as a group. Okay, thank you. This woman here, please.
Yes, I'm Najiba Khalil with Voice of America, mm-hmm. Afghan service. Mm-hmm. First of all, thank you so much for your great leadership and what you're doing for the women of Afghanistan, for mm-hmm. women of your country. Oslo Research Institute, as well as Georgetown Institute for Peace and Women, recently, on a report, ranked Afghanistan as one of the worst country when it came to women's situation. I want your input in that as well. In a different topic, what is your suggestion for Voice of America's programming content, radio, TV, web, to help so Afghan women can benefit from it to help them?
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
Okay, this woman over here.
Hi, my name is Chris Veenstra. I'm a social psychologist and just an interested participant. I'm curious, given the barriers that women have in Afghanistan for education, like security, transportation, and bathrooms, and I know that the internet is kind of sketchy there, and it can be, but I'm just curious as to what's being done in the space of sort of internet education, you know, given the explosion of online courses, and what's being done in that space to sort of help educate women at home rather than having them having to leave their home.
Okay, so distance learning via the internet. Okay, Emmy Simmons, please.
Thank you, Madam Ghani, and thanks, Dan, for pulling this together, because I think it's your point about being close to Thanksgiving and thinking of what we have to look at that's good, which you've done very, very well in your presentation, but also think about, well, how does that fit into the future of the world, the future of the country? A very, very important point. I think also what I've taken away from you is how we absolutely must remember how long it takes to recover from conflict. And I think your thought, you're mentioning of Syria, Yemen, you could have mentioned South Sudan, Somalia. Mm-hmm. We are facing this situation in so many countries, and I think Afghans' kind of experience and leadership is going to be important going forward. I wanted to thank you also for the video and your graphic anecdotes as a way of kind of giving a human face to this. I must say that the one slide in your video that we could perhaps talk about for another hour was the engineers, the women who were engineers. Because unlike many of the other women who were portrayed as being entrepreneurial and sort of being in control of their jobs, engineers generally are not in control exactly of their businesses, who they work for, et cetera. But the last question, since I'm a former USAID and now is working to some extent with CSIS, is, looking back, as you have in your remarks, but also looking forward, what should the international community, including USAID, but including people like Tony Wayne and the diplomatic community, really focus on to enable women and girls in Afghanistan to progress in the next decade?
Okay.
Because there has to be some points of focus, I would think, that come out of your own experience. Thank you so much.
I would like to answer the question about the engineers quickly, and then I'll conclude with the answer to the what can we do once I answer the other question.
Excellent.
These young women that you saw in the slide are working on the Qasr Darul-Aman, a palace that is in ruin. But it's a palace that was built at the beginning of the 20th century. And they're part of a team of engineers that are rebuilding it. And the teams are divided into several sections, like you have architecture, you have electricity, you have piping, water, I mean, all these things. And I know two of the girls are heads of teams.
That's
so, and have young men engineers under them. So it's refreshing. And they managed, actually, we had a call for bids for the first phase, which was to remove the you know, when you have a ruin, you have things that are, you cannot choose, you have to remove, debris in French, I don't know how to say it in English. Anyway, so we tried, the government asked for bids, and the lowest was, I think, $1 million. And then when we brought this group of young engineers, they did it for, I think, $60,000. Mm. So, and they did it perfectly, because it's a structure that's a little bit shaky. They were afraid things might fall and all this, but they did it. Okay, so let me start with your question, which was about street harassment. Yes, there is street harassment in Kabul. I think there is street harassment in a lot of countries.
This is male street harassment of women?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the only way to change it is through mentality, changing mentalities. And you know, mentality takes a long time to be changed and requires a change in culture. You know, we need plays, we need songs, we need, you know, a lot of movies that describe what is, you know, women harassment,
gender
harassment, and saying it's bad. Because you can tell somebody, this is bad, what are you doing? He'll just shake his shoulder, he won't really do. No, I agree, there is street harassment. I don't know much about it because I'm not allowed to walk in the streets. But all the women that come to see me sometimes mention it. So yes, you're right, there is a problem. Your question was regarding yes, the research that says, yeah. This is precisely the one statement that got me so annoyed when I first became First Lady. Because already I knew enough Afghan women. I had lived in Afghanistan a total of 15 years. I knew enough Afghan women to know that there were, you know, some women were able to make it in Afghanistan. So, this is why I proceeded to change the narrative. You know, this is, okay, they're really very well-meaning people, and they really mean to help and to improve the country. But sometimes they make assertions. Now, there is not one person who comes from a Nordic country, a Scandinavian country, that does not quote to me this particular sentence. And I says, no, I have lived in a lot of different countries. I've had the privilege of living both in the Middle East, in Europe, and in the States. In every country, there are a portion of women that are having a difficult time. Afghanistan, don't reduce Afghanistan just to that. There is so much more to Afghanistan. So I would object to their have people come and follow women in Afghanistan and see what they're doing. Real reportage, you know. Go to a girls' school. Go to a clinic. We now have a very wonderful new lab, the forgot name, Shafajou, I think, that has the latest instrument for analyzing, you know, blood, whatever, mammogram, all kinds of things. There is so much that is happening in Afghanistan that you really need to keep up with that and have good stories or have people tell you about their dreams. What do they want to do? So that you understand where they are and what they need, you know? Okay, there was
and if you run that show, we'll do an event here at CSIS, if VOA does that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there was a question about distance learning and the internet.
Distance learning. The internet is a very good tool. At the same time, it's a very dangerous tool. And I know for a fact that diplomas that are earned on the internet are not recognized by the Ministry of Education, because there are a lot of phony universities and phony things, and the Ministry of Education does not know who are the good ones and who are not the good ones. And so they just say, no diploma from a internet class is accepted. So that does not prevent people from learning on the internet if they want to learn, okay? So that's fine. But they will have problems using it on their CV or on whatever, I mean. Yes, yes. No, yeah. You have to understand the capacities of the Ministry of Higher Education to go and look on the internet and see whether this is a valid university or not are very limited.
Pretty limited.
So, unfortunately, right now, distance learning is not a solution.
So let's go to the last point you were going to close with.
The last point that Emmy Simmons was mentioning was what can
lessons
you
can we take, right? I think, Emmy, that was your question about what lessons can international aid community take to enable and further the progress of women and girls from the case of Afghanistan.
Okay. A general advice that I gave in the beginning is to do more monitoring. I realize there are the donors and then there are the international.
Then they're the doers.
There are the implementers.
Yes. Right.
And there is somehow a
disconnect
between. So sometimes the implementers feel free to do, and then it's the same thing with the implementers, which are the local NGOs. So somehow during that chain, the monitoring is totally lost. So that was a general advice. When it comes to women, I have two very clear requests. First of all, transfer real knowledge. We've had a lot of workshops for 2 weeks where they learn something. There is a board, and then there are things that are presented. They're very much, their incentive is the $5 transport fee.
Right.
So in 2 weeks, they might make $10 or $15. Ever. And they get a piece of paper that they add to their CV. I did this workshop. What did you learn? I don't know. I don't remember.
The food was good.
Exactly. I want real training. I want training, that's if good. Ever they're trained into accounting, that they can become accountants. If they are trained into a communication officer, they can write. They can. They understand between perspective writing and op-ed writing and narrative, you know, let them become professional. Don't cheat them out of a good education. It doesn't need to be a 3-year scholarship to a university, but whatever training, professional training you're giving, give true professional training. Hello, Andrea, I didn't notice you were here. Okay, so it's really very important because this is why sometimes project finish, NGOs close down or international aids move to another area and nothing remains. Nothing remains. It's not acceptable. So this is one. And as a continuation of number one, the two is mentoring and on-the-job training. Mentoring is very important because you might learn something that was described within a certain context, and when you go to your work or to your place of work, the context is different, and you're totally at a loss. You think, okay, what I learned cannot be applied here. It's not true. If you've gotten good knowledge, you should be able to apply it to the to wherever you're working. So mentoring can be, I know of some organization that do mentoring, distance mentoring, on the phone, on Skype. They are here, they have paired the women with somebody from that particular profession with the Afghan women, and then they talk every week, every or twice a week, and they they kind of figure out what to do. So mentoring is very important. If possible, online job training is even better, because this is a person who shadows another person, who has gotten the knowledge, I mean, has been given the knowledge. But the person stays in the background. And then at the end of the day, she says, well, you know, when you answered that, what was in your mind? And are you sure it should not have been something like that, going through all the events of that day and saying what went right, what went wrong. And that is really very important. If you want these women to become real pillars of society, you need to give them a real solid professional training.
Wow. Thank you so much. This was great. Please join me in thanking the First Lady of Afghanistan, Lola Ghani. Wow. I suspect several people are going to want to say hello to you here, so why don't I let you? I suspect there you have some friends in the audience, so I'll give you a few minutes to do that, and we'll reconvene in a few minutes.
Mind.
Of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes.